Welcome, everyone. This is Greg McKenzie, and you're listening to Season 2, Episode 2 of the Missiology Podcast. In this episode, Martin Rodriguez, your delightful host, sits down with the eminent Anabaptist missiologist Wilbert Schenck. Now, we had some technical difficulties. It was a remote interview, and you know how those go sometimes with equipment and so on. But we thought, no, this one's just too good. We're going to release it anyway. And so we really expect that you're going to enjoy these fascinating stories and insights from Dr. Schenck. And if you do, please show how much you appreciate what the podcast offers by supporting us at patreon.com/missiology or liking and sharing on, you know, all the socials, or commenting, leaving us some feedback at missiology.com. Any of these and any other way you can think to support the podcast is most welcome. Thanks again for listening, and without further ado, Season 2, Episode 2, with Wilbert Schenck.
Dr. Schenck, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for spending time with us at missiology.com. And we are grateful that to have you as a visitor on our podcast. And I'm the host, Martin Rodriguez. This is Professor Wilbert Schenck, Senior Professor of Mission and History and Contemporary Culture for many years at Fuller Theological Seminary. And Dr. Schenck, you come with a tremendous amount of experience. You've been an important voice when it comes to thinking about things like post-Christendom ecclesiology, when it comes to thinking about church and culture in the West. So we're grateful to get a chance to hear your stories. Thank you once again.
It's a privilege to be able to share with you, and I will do the best I can to be coherent and see if I can recall some of the important things that have happened and shaped me.
Well, let me go ahead and I'll dive right into my first question, perhaps. So the first question I want to ask you is about a memory, a primary experience that has shaped you in your theology and your missiology. Maybe a high point for you as a practitioner, as a scholar in this field, a time when you felt engaged and motivated, maybe an experience that has shaped you in your scholarship, in your missiology, in your theology. Tell me what happened, who was involved, and what did you do?
Well, I must say at the outset that I did not set out to be a missiologist. In fact, the term did not even exist, at least it was not used commonly when I was beginning my journey. I went overseas in 1955, and then to my surprise, I was later on invited into administrative leadership. But even until, let's say, 1970, the term missiologist was not commonly used in North America. Certainly, it might have been a little bit earlier in Europe, but in general, it was not a common term. And therefore, to say I aspired to be a missiologist would be a bit misleading, because we simply didn't use that term. What was done in those days was to offer mission studies, and that was usually heavily historical in its content, with some theology added to that. But there was not a well-defined theology of mission either. So missiology was not a well-developed field, certainly not among missionaries, but mission theology also was not well-developed. So there's been a huge development in the field of mission studies, which we now call missiology, in the last 50 years. And I was privileged to be a part of that development.
Interestingly enough, our very own Christine Kim, right, who at Fuller Theological Seminary, she still uses mission studies. In fact, she's the editor of the journal Mission Studies, right? So I think that there is some variety in the field as far as, like, what do we call it? Right? What are we actually studying here?
And I think we can say that the switch to missiology was made in North America around 1970. I was a part of the group that got together in 1972 to talk about organizing what became the American Society of Missiology. The journal Practical Anthropology, which had been published for almost 20 years, sponsored by the American Bible Society and a few other people involved in the field of anthropology, that was coming to an end. It was virtually defunct by 1970. So it was decided to bring practical anthropology under the wing of the newly emerging American Study of Missiology, and we would then publish a new journal. The journal was titled Missiology. And for a number of years, the masthead would show Missiology continuing practical anthropology. So with Missiology, continuing practical anthropology. So we wanted to keep that linkage, even though we were moving in new directions and certainly broadening the scope. So I can say that my launch into this came about because I was privileged to be a part of the group that was giving thought and leadership to organizing the American Society of Missiology. And that, I'm sure, accounts for the fact that in North America, missiology has been more widely accepted than in Europe, where they've retained some of the older nomenclature.
That's interesting. Yeah. So during that time, maybe there is a time that you, a memory that really kind of stands out to you. Perhaps it was a conversation, maybe even a high point in, so you said this is around the early 70s. So 1972, around that time, are there any memories that stand out for you during that time?
Well, I think I would have to back up, so to speak, go back. I had begun my administrative role in 1965 when I became a part of the administrative staff of the Mennonite Board of Missions. I was already then designated to succeed the long-term staff member, a senior person. I was to succeed him upon his retirement in 1967. But already in the first couple of years of my tenure as an administrator, I observed that you had basically two kinds of leaders in the field of mission, missionary work, to be more precise. And you had a very few people who were thinkers, who were reflecting on the work of the mission. I'm thinking here particularly of Max Warren, the great General Secretary of the Church Missionary Society in Great Britain, who put out a monthly think piece for many years, which many of us then read. But I sensed in Warren real stimulation. He was constantly looking at the issues that were evolving. He was, of course, a part of the British scene, which meant they had their large empire to dismantle in those years. So the end of the colonial era was very much on their minds. We as Americans didn't face that in the same way. But nonetheless, we were benefiting from the thinking that Warren and others were doing. Mm. I'm thinking, for example, Warren was the one who introduced the idea of Christian presence. He had people who were trying to relate in Islamic societies, or in another case of people who were working in Israel. How do you relate to people where there is high sensitivity, who feel where there's resistance, but yet you want to relate? Well, Warren was a leader in talking about the theology of presence. He commissioned the writing of a series of books, small books that fit into that theme, written from various perspectives. So I observed in Warren a mission leader who was an administrator, but he was also a leader in thought. And I said to myself, I know what I want to be. I do not want to be simply an administrator making decisions and running the machinery. I want to be on the side of those who are trying to think, reconceptualize, adjust where necessary. And in the midst of that, I discovered that mission theology ought to be brought into mission practice. You need to have the two working together. Otherwise, your theology is, as the British would say, airy-fairy. It's not touching down to reality. On the other hand, you don't want to simply run a program that is not well-informed theologically. So those were some of the starting points for my growing interest. And then another thing that was happening, which is very influential in my experience, our agency had become involved with what is known as African independent churches in West Africa, a term that is no longer used. It was the term African independent churches was an attempt to recognize these are indigenous groups that have emerged partly in reaction to the mission presence. The mission was very institutional. They had control of properties and so on, but they were not sensitive. They were not engaging the local culture in an effective way. So you have the emergence of these movements all over Africa. In fact, to many people's consternation, in the mid-1960s, David Barrett, who was just beginning to get his find his place in terms of mission thought and so on, he published a book called Schism and Renewal in Africa. He identified something like 5,000 movements all over the continent. But people were astonished. Mm-hmm. This independent, indigenous impulse was so powerful and so prevalent all over the continent. Well, that we were involved in that very clearly, very closely in Nigeria. So I began to spend more time thinking about some of these new developments. And then in 1972, 73, I began to feel the need to take a break from the administration. And at that point, I arranged, because I had learned to know Andrew Walls through his work in West Africa, I arranged to have a one-year study leave at Aberdeen University, where he was located by that time. And soon after I got there, we were talking about the research that I might do. He said, well, by the way, why don't you do research on Henry Venn? He was the great 19th century figure, one of the two authors of the three selves concept and so on. He said, you're an administrator. You might understand this administrator better than some of us who are just professors. So that's how I got pulled into the kind of research that was involved in a doctoral dissertation. And so my one-year sabbatical was extended to a second year so that I could finish my research at the CMS archives in London and write up the first draft of my dissertation. So by the time we came back to the U.S. in 1975, I had the whole dissertation in draft form. That was my launch into scholarship.
Okay. Yeah. That's excellent. Thank you for giving us some context and some background there. I really appreciate that. You know, one of the things you said is that before the scholarship phase, you were working as an administrator and you're working for, what was your position referred to? What was your title?
Well, these titles, you know, change over time. So I was first called the Secretary for Overseas Missions. Within the MENAT Board of Missions, there were six program divisions within the board. I was responsible for the overseas division, which was the largest and had the most people. We had 150 people in service at that time.
Okay. So
that was my starting point.
What is it?
The whole nomenclature, I became vice president of overseas ministry, but that's still the same basic set of responsibilities.
Okay, yeah. So we change titles. I mean, and some things become politically incorrect, right? We move away from them for theological reasons as well. So one of the questions that I had is what is it that motivated you to start working for the Mennonite Board of Missions? I mean, you're moving into administration. Was that something that had been modeled for you by maybe a father or a mentor figure, or how did you get involved with that?
That's the first great surprise of my life. I didn't have any ambitions and didn't think of that as a calling after my 4 years of work in Indonesia as a volunteer. I came back to the States. My wife and I then went to Eugene, Oregon, where I studied at the University of Oregon. And I assumed I was going to go into higher education, secondary education, because I had some interest in that. And just as I was about to accept the position, I got a call from the Central Committee with whom I had worked in Indonesia. And they said, would you please come and be part of the administrative staff at the headquarters? So that was the way I got pulled in. And then within a year and a half, I was being invited to go to the Mennonite Board of Missions with a view to becoming the vice president or the secretary, because the man who had been at it for 20 plus years was retirement age and very much eager to retire. So I was then, within a short time, I went through these stages of move from one position to another position to another position.
Yeah, yeah.
Ended up, and I had no indication earlier on that I would be doing that. It was a complete surprise.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious, what were you planning on teaching in secondary school? I mean, before everything shifted toward the Mennonite Board of Missions, what were you planning on teaching in secondary school?
I had some interest in the area of business studies at the secondary level. I didn't fully understand what that was going to mean, because that was also evolving, the field was evolving. But I thought maybe I might get into administration within the high school system, you know, get a principalship perhaps down the road. But that was all just a dream.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like there's other people who noticed in you very quickly. You describe this change of titles and kind of the move really quickly to secretary into that position. It sounds like there was around you people that were noticing a gift for leadership and administration in you. They were noticing this capacity that you had.
That's right. And it was, so I was not aggressively seeking. They came seeking me, and so took that as God's way of working in my life.
That's right. So Indonesia, you were there volunteering for, you said, 4 years. Is that what you said?
I spent 4 years there, yes.
Okay.
The churches in Indonesia had gone through a really difficult time. There was, first of all, the Japanese occupation, early 40s. And then immediately following the end of World War II, Indonesia declared its independence from the Dutch. They were a colony of the Dutch, and the Dutch did not accept that. So that immediately led them into a war of revolution, which went on for 3 years, very destructive. The churches lost all of their institutions, their schools, their hospitals, their clinics. All of this was lost in the war. And so after the war, our agency, the Mennonite Central Committee, came into Indonesia because there's a Mennonite church there, had been there for quite a long time, started by the Dutch Mennonites. But the need of the hour was to redeveloped their medical services, their educational services. And so as a part of my task there, I taught in the reopened high school in Indonesia.
Okay.
So it was a combination of administration and teaching.
So when you think about your, how you've been influenced by other scholars and practitioners, you've already mentioned, you know, how important Warren was, right? In those conversations that you were, things that you were reading from Warren, who's writing on, Christian presence at the end of the colonial period, and you're wanting to, you're connecting with thinkers even that early. I mean, this is mid 60s. Who would you say, maybe name one or two, maybe conversations or books that have really contributed to your own formation, your own research and ministry? What was the content of those conversations? Why did they make a difference for you?
Well, I would say before all of that, I encountered and then worked with the leader of the Indonesian, Javanese Mennonite Church. A remarkable person, and I would I would say I discovered contextualization before it was a term because of him. He was well-educated. He had gone through the higher theological college in Jakarta. So he had a Dutch-oriented theological education. So he was very well-informed. But he had this marvelous gift of working with Europeans in a way that we all respected him. He was our teacher, even though he was not much older than me. He was such a wise, thoughtful, respectful person. And so he respected his own culture in a way that you couldn't help but be impressed with. So he looked for the worldview that was behind the old Javanese literature tradition and the art tradition. And he would talk about these things. And so I began to understand that he was trying to make the Christian faith at home in that culture. So long before I ever heard the word contextualization, I saw someone at work who was contextualizing, doing it very effectively. So that was really, without my knowing it, was my launch into missiology, say, long before the term was around, because he was just doing it. He was a practitioner, thoughtful practitioner, very respectful, who could hold the attention of both Europeans and his own people. Marvelous gift that he gave, not knowing it, very unpretentious.
I'm curious, can you remember some of the things, maybe even specific conversations or lessons that you had with him, with this Javanese Mennonite leader?
It's hard to recall a specific, but he would make comments that Europeans don't quite get it. They don't listen. And so he was patiently trying to get my attention, I suppose, and others' attention. At the same time, he was mediating. He was helping you understand the significance of that for the way people think and act. So it was subtle in a way, gentle. He was not bombastic, but very perceptive.
Was he someone that you worked alongside with on a weekly basis? Was this something that you were kind of a co-worker on a regular basis?
Yeah, we were in touch all the time. He wasn't in the school. He didn't spend time in the school, but he would stop at the house where we lived, and we would go to his house and consult. We were in constant contact.
Yeah. Excellent. That's very helpful. Tell me his name again.
Suhadeveko Joyo Diharjo. That's a long name, but he was called Joyo, meaning father. Papa. Joyo was the way all the people in the community knew him.
Well, thank you. That's wonderful. I like hearing about Joyo.
He is the first missiologist I ever met. I didn't know it at the time. In retrospect, I realized it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I think it's interesting that one of the messages that you remember him saying is, they aren't listening. Right, they aren't listening. They aren't listening. That's an important message for perhaps missiologists. It continues to be an important message, right? Are we listening?
It's always a pertinent observation.
My third question is explicitly about God's agency, so God's initiatives in your life as a missiologist, as a practitioner. Can you describe a time when you recognized that God was clearly shaping you in this moment to become the scholar practitioner that you are today and that you became? Tell me how this happened. What was happening?
I wouldn't point to a moment. I would point to a process. It was an evolutionary process. So one thing built on another. And I can't say any better than that, because there was nothing intentional. I didn't have my eyes set on a professorship or anything of that sort. I was simply working as I felt I was called to do by the church and by colleagues and so on. And so it was an evolution over the years. And so by the mid-1980s, I was beginning to feel that maybe it was good that I consider stepping down, because staying too long in a position is not necessarily good for anyone, including yourself. And so I served notice with the president of the board at that time and said that I would plan to step out of my role in by the beginning of 1990. And that was accepted. By that time, I already had my PhD, but I had no idea what I would be doing. Well, almost immediately after I made that decision, the president of the Mennonite Seminary came and asked if I would consider joining their faculty because the person who had been teaching was retirement age, and so they wanted someone to pick up that piece. But then something else rather unforeseen happened. The key figure in my doctoral program was Andrew Walls. Mm-hmm. He's now celebrated the world over. He's just been one of the great figures in the whole field of mission studies the last 50 years. And I had first met him in Nigeria, after I was in the mission administration. And that's how I got to Aberdeen. A colleague of his, they were very close colleagues, and shared their interest with a man named Harold Turner. Harold Turner was a New Zealander who had gone to Africa to teach at Fura Bay College in Sierra Leone, which happened to be where Andrew Walls was. So they became fast friends very soon. Harold Turner wrote a 2-volume dissertation on one of the major independent churches, these AICs that I talked about earlier. So he was one of the emerging authorities on independency as a phenomenon. And Harold Turner, they both left in Nigeria because of the civil war in 1966, 67, 68. All the foreigners had to leave and went to Britain and then to Aberdeen. So it was both of them were in Aberdeen when I was doing my dissertation research. Oh, in the midst of that, we'd only been in Aberdeen about 3 months, and a visiting scholar came by. They often had visitors like this come, and they'd give a public lecture and so on. And this was a young South African I had never heard about, but Andrew Walls had met him somewhere. And so David Bosch was this guest lecturer on that occasion. And that evening after the lecture, we were invited to the home of Harold and Maud Turner. So we had the privilege of a meal with the Turners and with David Bosch. In the midst of that, and this was 1973, fall of 73, in the midst of that conversation, Bosch turned to me and said, "Do you perchance know a person by the name of Yoder?" And I tumbled to that. I said, "You mean John Howard Yoder?" "Yes." Now, it turned out that they were both students in Basel at the same time and sat through the lectures of Karl Barth. Karl Barth was then, I think, in volume 3 or something, and he was going on and on as European professors did. And Bosch and Yoder sat side by side in this lecture. I can imagine it must have been 100 students in big, big lecture groups. And Bosch said, "At a certain point, Karl Barth made this comment. He said, if Hitler's army had come across that bridge, coming into Switzerland from Germany, he said, I would have had to take up arms." Yoder stands up. They both Bosch and Yoder were both big men, about 6'4" or 6'5". Yoder stands up and said, "Jesus would not have done that." He's profoundly impressed with this. And so in the conversation that evening, he said, "Oh, so you know Yoder." He said, "Where is he now?" He'd lost all contact. So I had a copy of an essay Yoder had just recently written on, I forget what the exact title was anyway, but it was something right on target for Bosch. And Bosch was just beginning publication of his journal from South Africa. He wanted to publish that article. So how can I contact Yoder? Anyway, that led to a renewed contact between those two men, and Bosch got the article to publish as he hoped. And later on, then Bosch came and spent a sabbatical leave. He lived in Elkhart, Indiana, where the seminary was. And he taught one course and did some other research. Anyway, that led to a continuing relationship between me and Bosch.
That's a great story, by the way. I love hearing about that, those connections.
It shows the humanity, the humanness, the emotional side of people. And, you know, Yoder stands up and says, Jesus did not do that. And Bosch was just stopped. Bart was just stopped in his tracks. Bart knew Yoder, and he had respect for him. He was a brilliant mind. It's a marvelous story. Very few people know that story, by the way.
I had never heard that before, but I love hearing that.
Then because of all these connections that had developed along the way, in 1983, this is a sidetrack in a way, but it's going to come back together. The British Council of Churches was having one of their periodic retrospectives, what are we going to do? We're going to do, the churches are losing members, things are falling apart. And so they had this big discussion in their British Council of Churches meeting. And they decided that we have to do something about this. They just had a new survey telling them how bad things were. So they decided, someone gets the idea, let's ask Leslie Newbigin to write, I would call it kind of a prospectus. What can we do in the light of this? Newbigin was not at the meeting, but he was given this assignment. And the story was told by one of the people in the council, sort of in jest, but he said, Newbigin got the assignment when he was in London, and on his ride back on the train to Birmingham, where he was living at that time, he drafted this piece. Now, you may not be aware of it. The title of this little booklet is Beyond 1984.
Yep. Yeah.
And that turned into a bestseller. It just caught fire. And so the British Council suddenly had some intellectual capital to work with. And they then took for the council, Newbigin was involved by that time in the discussions. And they decided we have to do something. We've got to mobilize the people of the Christians of this nation to do something positive. And so out of that came the Gospel in Our Culture program in Great Britain. And Newbigin was the head director of that. A friend of his, Dan Beebe, was the administrator of it. And in the midst of that, Harold Turner had moved to Birmingham where the other two were. And Harold Turner made the suggestion that, why don't you approach the Mennonites in North America about giving some staff time to this project? So I got pulled into that. I was leaving my administrative work. I got pulled into that. So I spent 6 months each year for 3 years living in Birmingham, working with Newbigin and Dan Beebe as they were trying to mobilize. And their goal was to have this big national assembly in 1992, where they bring together their findings and try to get clergy and lay leaders involved in new ways in the life of the church and so on. In the meantime, then in North America, another movement was taking place parallel to the British, but not the same way in terms of organization. We called it the Gospel in Our Culture Network in North America. We got that organized in the latter part of the 1980s. So that was the beginning of my continuing interest then in the field of contemporary culture. That's really the starting point of that. But Newbigin is the mind behind all this, and in response to that crisis that they were feeling in Great Britain. And Newbigin went on the writing and speaking. I had a wonderful relationship with him in the last years. I was there part of the time, but we would stay in touch otherwise. And it was just very inspiring to be in his presence and to hear him speak. Passion about the future of the faith.
Do you remember any of those conversations that you were able to have with him, those interactions?
It's hard for me to recount a particular conversation. It's more that I observed him he invited me on a couple of occasions. I don't know why, but he, to give you an example, there were two young women. I think they were theology students at some college maybe in Birmingham. I never knew them and had nothing to do with them beyond. Anyway, they took issue with something Newbegin had written. He was writing out every new issue of the Gospel Our Culture bulletin, which I think was every 2 months. He would have a think piece at the beginning. It always led into the reporting. And these young women were apparently quite annoyed with the way he handled women and so on. I mean, he used traditional language, let's leave it at that. And they were really annoyed about this. And so Newbegin was very humble. He said, I want to meet with you. Come, I want to talk with you. And then he invited me to sit in with him on that occasion. And I was impressed. He listened very patiently and humbly. He didn't buy their line. I mean, he accepted some of the criticism, but he also didn't. Essentially, he was not uncomfortable with his own position. But several times he invited me in to participate when he was having some kind of a. He was feisty. he was a nice gentleman in public, but he had his feisty side too. And so a couple of times like that, he invited me to sit in.
Why do you think he invited you?
I don't know. He never told me. I think he knew that I could listen and that we would talk about it afterwards. Goodness, he's such a bright mind, and I couldn't hold a candle to him. But he was very, he was humble. He was, you know, he was very accessible. Even while he had this tremendous range of intellectual and theological interests. Fascinating character.
That's excellent. So when you think about your own scholarship, your own contributions to this ongoing conversation that we refer to as mission studies and missiology, what would you say are your contributions? What's been your greatest, maybe I should say your most valuable contributions to the theory and the practice? I'm especially interested in experience that gave rise to these, conceptual developments for you.
Well, as you can tell from what I've said so far, they're rather situational. I would meet unexpectedly, but have an encounter, and that would lead to something. And then, so it was not pre-planned or programmed. I did not stay concentrated in one area the way Dudley Woodberry, our dean, when I was first hired at Fuller, was always an Islamicist. That was his focus. He never departed from that. As you can see, I've gone from history and theology of mission into contemporary culture, and now I'm supposed to be working on a work on pastoral missiology with someone else. We're way behind time, way behind schedule. But well, I had to take time out. I was treated for colon cancer in 2019 and 20, so I've lost some time for that reason. But anyway, so I would say I have not been able to, really go deep in one field or stay in one particular category, but I have worked across several different areas, and you pay a price for that. I know that. If I want to really be, after all, Karl Barth spent his whole career writing 4 volumes of systematic theology. That was a typical pattern of real scholars in the past. It's less, I think, less true today. But so I don't feel like I have gone deeply into these areas, but I have done enough, I think, to lead students to know what's there and how to go about it. So I have seen myself more as a guide rather than the person who's generating all the intellectual capital.
That's good. You wrote an article that it was a response to Transforming Mission by David Bosch. And that article has an interesting history kind of behind it. And I'm interested, would you be willing to kind of share with us a little bit about this article related to Transforming Mission that you wrote?
Well, how could anyone criticize Transforming Mission? It's sold 80,000 copies. Just phenomenal. You know, I don't know how many languages it's been translated into, so it'll stand for a long time as one of the benchmarks. I must say that my disappointment when I saw the book for the first time back in 92, I was disappointed that Bosch had written this book as a very Western, in fact, European volume. Now, he curtsies this way and that way sometimes to acknowledge other parts of the world, but I really was disappointed. Here he was, a person who had worked among indigenous Africans. When Bosch finished his program in Basel, he had to go through the usual examination process and so on. Karl Barth was on his committee along with Oscar Kuhlmann, another person I don't remember. Anyway, and Bosch went back to South Africa. This must have been 57 by that time, going in there. And his church, the Church of South Africa, the Dutch Reformed Church of South Africa, had just passed its endorsement of apartheid. And they actually officially endorsed apartheid. Bosch arrives back in South Africa, and he stands up and says, I guess in their church assembly, I cannot endorse apartheid. Because of that stand that he took, they didn't kick him out of the church, but they would not allow him to pastor a church in South Africa. The only thing he was allowed to do was to be a missionary to Black Africans. Imagine that. So he's allowed to go out into the rural area across on the east side in South Africa and became a missionary. And there he worked very, very hard. In fact, he lost his health partly from that. But he went out, he worked with rural congregations. He would ride a horse. He was too rugged. He didn't have cars. You couldn't get in there by cars. He would ride his horses out into the mountains to meet with these people. And he really, and at night he was studying anthropology to better understand how cultures work and how you appreciate cultures and all this. He does that until his health breaks. And then he finally, so he has to leave that that missionary post. He's then hired, he's not allowed to teach in any Dutch seminary, the Dutch Reformed Church seminary in South Africa, because he's on that forbidden list, on the blacklist. But he was allowed to teach at the University of South Africa, which was a government. Isn't this strange? The government-run university allows him to teach, but he can't be a pastor. He can't teach in the seminary. So he ends up setting up this department of theology in the University of South Africa, UNISA.
That's so interesting.
He's on that faculty until he's killed, tragically killed in that car accident in 1992.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying I felt somewhat aggrieved when I read his big book, marvelous as it is. It's all Western Europe, not even much American scholarship in it. Really, he draws on the core of the proper theology. And so I was always a bit contorted about that. So that's the background. If you want background to the article, it's partly I couldn't give a full-throated endorsement because I felt he had missed a very important opportunity. It was too late for him, I think, maybe too, but still, I couldn't understand this. Hmm.
So really part of what, to go back to the theme of listening, right? I mean, they came up early on, but part of what you have, one of this really important contributions that you've made, and it's, you've made it consistently, I would say, across the board in all of these different focuses in your scholarship, but that the importance of listening, right? The importance to listening to voices from the non-Western world, right? And so that's part of your critique of David Bosch's work is, well, where are the other voices? And you know, are we listening to the voices of our own culture as we're thinking as churches, you know, in contemporary culture? But the theme of listening has been a really life-giving and important theme throughout your scholarship. So here's the last question that I have for you. It's about hopes for missiology. You know, if you had, and you're thinking right now, maybe, you know, you're writing one, perhaps one last book, maybe a couple of, maybe some more articles, but here you're nearing the end of your career and your scholarship. And my question is, if you had two or three wishes for missiology over the next decade or two, right? So we're looking forward now. What would be your hopes for the changing shape of the ongoing? I mean, you mentioned this early on, right? This has changed a lot. But when you think about the ongoing shaping of missiology as a discipline, what is what would be one or two wishes that you have?
Well, if I'm somewhat aggrieved by Bosch's not taking the third goal seriously, I'm more profoundly aggrieved by the theological education establishment in the West, which refuses at every turn. You cannot get a serious hearing for mission, the mission of God. And so we go on training people in spirituality or in counseling or in whatever, gender studies and so on. All these are important things. But we're not equipping the oncoming generation of pastoral leaders, church leaders of all sorts, to understand the mission of God in what they're doing. And so it seems to me we're always going to limp along. We're not going to really do what I think God calls the church to do. Because we just refuse to give up our old patterns, our old ways of looking at things, and especially in theological education. We're not training pastors in the way I think they ought to be trained, to see every local congregation as an embassy. I think it's a very important term, which we find in 2 Corinthians 5. We are embassies wherever we are for the kingdom, for the witness. And most of us don't think that way. It's so far removed from the reality that that's enough to keep me going.
Yeah, that's great. Unpack the term embassy for me. Unpack that term a little bit. What does that mean for you when you think of a rich term that's coming from Paul? What does it mean for churches today?
Well, as it says in 2 Corinthians 5, we are ambassadors. So why can't we see the local church gathered as that embassy which is constantly sending ambassadors into its context? Coming and going, we're coming and going, we're mediating, we're listening, we're counseling, but we're so self-satisfied, so self-enclosed. And so that's what, if I have one passion, is that, and I don't know how to do more than I've done, but I continue to feel that is the burning passion that I have.
Yeah, that's an important prayer, an important hope, and an important wish. Dr. Shank, I can't thank you enough for this time. It's been rich. I appreciate hearing your stories and hearing the many clear ways that God has been shaping you in processes throughout your life, right? I mean, it's something that you're able to look back and say, clearly God's hand was at work here in the different movements, the different turns that the journey took. And you mentioned that you had been struggling with colon cancer. So that was in 2019 and 2020. Mm-hmm. My prayer is that you'll have the energy, the space and time in your schedule to be able to finish this text on pastoral missiology. That sounds like an interesting book that you're working on right now. Do you want to give us a little preview of it? Just maybe a two sentences. What's this book about?
Well, I'm writing it with Steve Sage. Steve is a pastor. He did his DMIS with me in the DMIS program about 5 years ago. I think he finished, and so he's got strong academic interests and preparation, but he also has this ongoing pastoral experience to draw on. So I wanted to team up with someone younger who had is, you know, firmly planted in the pastoral scene, because I'm not in that role. So that's what we're working on together. But so far, it's been somewhat delayed because he took a new position a couple of years ago and moved and got drawn into other things at that point. And I then was ill. So all of that's derailed our project for some time, but we're getting back into it.
All right. Well, it'll be good to have you back on the podcast, perhaps to discuss your book in a couple of years or whenever that comes out. We'll be looking forward to it.
Delighted to do it. Yeah.
All right. Dr. Shank, thank you again for this time, the Missiology podcast, and our listeners. Thank you. And we pray blessings over you and continued work in God's kingdom.
Thank you very much. God bless.